Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're delighted to have with us one of our regulars to kick things off for the week. His name is Bill Walton. He is, among other things, a former Master of the Universe on Wall Street, where he ran a company called Allied Capital Corporation. He has moved on to become the star of The Bill Walton Show, a terrific television podcast I had the privilege of being on last week. And we're going to talk, for starters, a little bit about that program, not so much my participation in it, but the featured guest really was Rosemary Gibson. Bill, you have done a lot with Rosemary over the years. Talk a little bit about her work and why this program was particularly timely.
Well, Frank, thanks for coming on my show last week. We, as you know, talked with Rosemary about her book called China RX, which is about America's dependency upon China for most of our critical drugs, not only generic, but some of the critical pharmaceuticals that we count on, diabetes, heart drugs, that sort of thing. And the components, yeah, well, they make, China particularly is critical to the subcomponents that are included in drugs, the so-called rare earth minerals, among other things. And China is also involved with India. India does a lot of the final packaging, but nevertheless, it's driven by China. And China's had an explicit strategy for the last 20 years, to be a dominant provider of pharmaceuticals around the world. And they've cut deals with most of the major pharmaceutical companies, including Pfizer and Merck. You know, Pfizer and Merck have both shut down research and development facilities here in the United States and put them in China. I think Merck's
possibly go wrong? And Bill, this is really the point. It's not just the supply chain issue of whether or not, you know, those supplies of vital medicines are going to be available when we need them. We saw a little bit of that early on in the COVID crisis. But it's also the possibility, and Rosemary spoke powerfully about this, that some of these drugs, at least, might be contaminated in ways that make them not only not helpful, but actually harmful to the people taking them.
Well,
talk about that.
The alarming news you and I got, you and I were on the show, did a show 2 years ago with Rosemary about her book, and really not much has gotten better, and some things have gotten much worse. At the time, we talked about the Food and Drug Administration and how difficult it was for them to bring their inspectors into China. The Chinese were harassing them every step of the way to prevent them from inspecting the Chinese drug manufacturing facilities, and you know, they're thousands of them scattered around the country. And so what's happened since then is the Chinese are now arguing that they should get the same reciprocity inspection, federal inspection, as the Europeans are getting, which means we would rely on the Chinese drug inspectors to tell us what's the quality of what they're making. Well, once again, research. And then here's their bright idea. Well, if you don't want, you can't have the physical inspectors here, but we'll give you Zoom inspections. And so they're going to go in with cameras and surveil the.
The Chinese are going to go in with cameras.
Chinese
show you what they want you to see.
Employee of the Chinese Communist Party inspecting our drugs with their iPhone.
Yeah. Let me just say, this is a prime example of the terrific work you're doing with this Bill Walton show. And I really I'm so delighted to be able to feature it. I'd like to take time to talk to you about another one, which is really important, featuring our friend Dr. Peter Vincent Pride, but that's for another day, because I want to turn to some developments at the Fed. You are the guy that we rely on to keep track of what's going on there, and there are two pieces of this that I thought were really important to note. One, of course, the Fed has begun raising interest rates at last, but also nominee President Biden had put forward to be the vice chairman has withdrawn. Give us the backstory on both of those, if you would.
Let's take the second one first. The very good news is that Sarah Bloom Raskin, who was the nominee to become head of the Fed, vice chairman of the Fed's regulatory activities, that nomination was withdrawn. She withdrew it because Joe Manchin, West Virginia, who's becoming a hero, refused to support her. And one of the reasons maybe the principal reason he refused to support her is that she's at the tip end of the spear of weaponization of finance. And she is a climate change radical that just knows no limits to what we ought to do to shut down fossil fuels. And she's written extensively and spoken extensively about how banks should no longer finance fossil fuel companies, all of them, not just the big ones, but the little ones. And using lack of access to capital to shut down fossil fuels. So getting at their climate change agenda through the banking system, in addition to all the other things they're trying to do on the regulatory front. So not having Sarah Raskin Bloom on that job is terrific. Now, it's a short-term big win for us. Longer term, let's see who else he tees up. His record of teeing up people that we like is... I think he's zero out of 450 so far.
but even the chairman of the outfit, Jay Powell, has been signaling his enthusiasm for this so-called ESG, Environment, Social Justice, Governance agenda, has he not? And although certainly we're going to see others being trotted out who will have a similar kind of view. And I guess the point is, this isn't happening in isolation, Bill, as you've talked about with me from time to time for months now. Larry Fink of BlackRock, the 800-ton gorilla on Wall Street, has been pushing companies that BlackRock, with its $10 trillion under management, has been using its influence, its leverage, to compel companies across the street to do the same. Is that right? And is this going to change anytime soon, do you think?
Larry's getting some. One of the things that we've done is we've done a little Saul Alinsky on Larry, and we've made the issue personal with him. He does not like the spotlight. Even Warren Buffett's partner, Charlie Munger, came out saying we don't want to be subjects to Larry Fink's rule. But even having said that, his positions are really unchanged in the type of companies and agendas that he wants to promote with his shareholder votes. You know, he and State Street and Vanguard control about 25-30% of the voting shares in New York Stock Exchange, so they're big players. Let's not get, even though Larry's feeling a little heat, let's not get too cocky, because all the other CEOs of the big financial firms, including Brian Moynihan and Bank of America and Jamie Dimon, not so much, but most of them have joined the ESG bandwagon. And look out for what happens with Bank of America. I expect they're going to try to follow Sarah Bloom's Raskin agenda and start cutting off Bank of America finance to fossil fuel industry in the way they've done it with other industries like the gun shops, which they cut off capital to. So
a serious problem for not just, you know, the fossil fuel industry, which is vital, of course, to our energy security posture in this country, but also to our society. Bill, I'm going to run out of time. I just need you to hold that thought, if you would, because I want to come back on the other side of a very short break to talk with you about this business about weaponizing finance. We should be doing some of that, it seems to me, with respect to the Chinese Communist Party, our mortal enemy. But instead, Larry Fink and others like him, as you say, have been pushing our money, our capital in the stock market and investment portfolios of pension funds and the like into communist China, propping them up. We're going to talk about some other developments in this sort of economic warfare space with Bill Walton of The Bill Walton Show. the proprietor of one of the most important podcasts, television podcasts, certainly in the country as I see it. And I'm very pleased to have been a guest on that program. Home and home, as they say, Bill. It's good to have you here in return. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton on specifically what economic warfare might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senate hearings begin today on President Biden's nominee to be the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Since a few Republican senators supported her recent appointment to the D.C. Appeals Court, this process is expected to be mostly a formality. That should not be the case. For one thing, Judge Brown Jackson is a longtime radical leftist activist. She has publicly professed being inspired by the Maoist strategy for dividing and conquering America known as critical race theory, the divisive and ahistorical 1619 Project, and seditious Black Lives Matter protests. There is, of course, a place for adherence to such sentiments in a free society, but it's not on the U.S. Supreme Court. For another, as Dr. Carol Swain observes, a nomination process that explicitly was limited to black female candidates violates the Constitution. That's a problem, too. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Walton, friend and colleague of now many years. He has been very influential on Wall Street. He's now very influential through his television podcast, The Bill Walton Show. And Bill, one of the things that I think really requires some close scrutiny at the moment is the way in which economic warfare is actually being pursued at the moment, not just by the Chinese Communist Party, of course, but now by NATO and the United States. Joe Biden is headed off to Europe to talk about this and more, I'm sure, with our NATO allies this week. Give us a flavor of, first of all, what are the various sanctions that have been imposed in response to Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine doing to the Russian economy, to its currency, and potentially to, you know, how the world's economic system operates?
Well, it's had the economic sanctions by the EU in particular have been a real crushing blow on most of the China or most of the Russian economy. They've after the entrance, after their last invasion of a small country, Crimea in 2014, Putin announced an import, I think it was, I can't remember his title for it, but they were going to become less import dependent. And that just has not succeeded. The growth industries in Russia have been technology related industries, and 90% of what they do in technology relies on imports of subcomponents from the rest of the world. And so we've got this lopsided economy now where oil and gas, fossil fuels, natural gas, the production's fallen off, but most people are still buying oil and natural gas from Russia, notwithstanding the sanctions. The rest of the country, though, is really problematic. You can't even get pet food in Russia. And the question for Putin is, how long will the Russian people put up with this? It's already, since 2014, GDP per person has fallen almost 10%, while the rest of Europe has grown by about 10%. So they're declining rapidly in relation to other European countries. And it's beginning to create some unrest. Whether that puts pressure on Putin to wrap this up quickly remains to be seen.
Bill, to the extent that we have seen people continuing to buy Russian energy. It's particularly noteworthy that the Indians have done a deal with Putin that not only will involve large amounts of natural gas, I believe, and oil coming from Russia to India in violation of the sanctions, but also that the deal's denominated in rupees. The Russians are taking rupees instead of petrodollars, as they're called. Talk about that, would you, and also about Saudi Arabia and what they're doing with the Chinese of a similar
kind. Frank, what's happening in the Russian economy is a sideshow. I mean, it's already per capita, they rank 68 in the world now, and they're already, they've been suffering for a long time. The headline here is that what the Biden administration has done with its desire to shut down the fossil fuel industry in the United States has led, to Putin feeling aggressive about going into Ukraine, but it's also making countries all over the world decide, well, maybe they don't want to rely on the dollar, the petrodollar, to buy their oil with. And as you mentioned, China is already talking with Saudi Arabia about buying its oil in yuan. Now, that's about 6 million barrels, and China imports about, I think, 25% of the of their oil from Saudi Arabia already. I may have that number jarbled a bit. I can come back to you on it, but it's a lot. And if they switch to yuan as opposed to dollars, that's a big change. With India buying oil from Russia in rupees, that's another change. And what's happening, people, even African countries are thinking, well, maybe we need to create a currency block to buy our oil in something other than dollars. India, Pakistan, Russia have already, Russia and China have already been talking about a currency block to trade in, to trade oil in. And so the big risk here is that the United States is could lose its status as the world's, the dollar could lose its status as the world's reserve currency. And if that happens, our $30 trillion in deficits, our $2 or $3 trillion annual deficits, all that becomes much, much more problematic because it's unclear how we would finance it. So these people are tempting the fates here with all this climate insanity that's not only making us dependent on the world for our oil and gas, or at least some of it, but the reserve currency for me is the very, very big, big issue here. And it's unclear how this is going to unfold. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of grown-ups in the Biden administration or wise people, including Janet Yellen or Jay Powell, who seem to be capable of doing much about it.
Well, first of all, they're not doing anything about the climate change agenda other than intensifying it, of course. That's the policy of the Biden administration. But to your larger point, Bill, they seem to be so sanguine about the immutability of the dollar as the reserve currency of the world that they can't be bothered stopping, for example, the printing presses from continuing to generate more and more dollars worth less and less, which I think is at the heart of this problem, as is, of course, sort of responses to the SWIFT decision and other economic sanctions that, you know, rely heavily on, you know, the dollar's preeminence. So, Bill, do you see an alternative? You mentioned regional arrangements, but is there really emerging now a workable alternative to the dollar, do you think? And if so, wouldn't that catalyze very quickly this kind of replacement?
Not yet. 80% of the world's oil trades in dollars. So there's a big, big delta to go from dollars to something else. What we could be seeing happening, though, is instead of globalization, we could be seeing regionalization. You know, China's already looking inward to look for finance inside China as opposed to going outside the world for its investment dollars. And we're seeing that with Xi's crackdown on the technology companies. And, you know, Russia's already talked about not being dependent on imports for its economy, and they're basically saying, well, look, we'd rather have a smaller, more primitive economy than trade in the world where we're dependent upon all these other countries for essentials. A lot of countries are beginning to think like that, And so this is a tectonic shift. I don't see it. This is not like the dollar is going to be replaced next week. But countries around the world are looking at the United States, and they're looking at the ham-handed way that we got out of Afghanistan, the arbitrary way we've shut down our own fossil fuel industry. They're looking at leadership here, and they're saying, we can't trust them. And therefore, we've got to look for our own sorts of finance, our own relationships, all sorts of bilateral arrangements with countries that they feel they can do business with, and trying to leave America out of the equation. That's a big problem.
Yeah. Well, the phenomenon of separate pieces that countries may well be striking with, well, the Russians, the Chinese, notably. And it brings me back to something you touched on there a moment ago, Bill. We have been arguing, as you know, and you've been very helpful in this, that we should not be investing American pension funds and the like in China. The Chinese market has been subject of late to considerable volatility. Does that powerfully reinforce the general argument we've been making about Larry Fink and others, as we talked about previously, making this sort of investment in our most dangerous enemy is now not only a bad idea strategically, but it seems to be pretty perilous financially for the investors themselves?
Well, here's the problem. China is the world's second largest economy. It's almost its largest consumer goods market. And we've seen in the last 10, 15, 20 years, American-based multinationals rush into China to grab market share. Well, that was before Xi really began to exercise his whip hand. And China is becoming less and less investable. We've seen the market cap of the big Chinese tech companies aggregate, I think it was like $4 trillion 3 years ago. And after he began cracking down, I think the market capping aggregate now is $1.4 trillion. So a loss of, more than half. And also the volatility that exists because everything depends on the whims of the Chinese Communist Party. Investors got scared, spooked that Xi was going to shut down foreign investment, the investment markets in China. Markets plummeted in the last 2 weeks, almost 20, 30, 40%. It was a bloodbath. And then the Chinese Communist Party regulators came in and said, no, we're going to protect the market. And all of a sudden, the prices whip back up to where they are about where they were 2 weeks ago. Now, you could breathe a sigh of relief. I wouldn't. What this says is that you can't depend on market fundamentals to determine whether your investment dollars are going to be safe. It'll depend on whether the Chinese Communist Party wants to protect your particular investment. That's not a bet I would make, and I don't think it's a bet anyone should make.
Yeah. Most especially people who are betting with your money without really your knowledge or desire for them to be doing so. Bill, there's so much more to talk with you about. As always, we run out of time before we run out of topics, but it's always delightful to have a chance to visit with you, even if occasionally the tidings are not entirely happy. Thank you for the work you do at the Bill Walton Show, and of course for your visits here with us each week. We appreciate them greatly, and we look forward to catching up with you again next week. Next up, we're going to speak with another of our regulars, Reggie Littlejohn, and she's going to give us an update on this phenomenon of digital health cards. Is this a way of introducing the Chinese social credit system here in America? What would that mean for you? That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. She is the founder and president of a remarkable organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She has been an activist on behalf of not just women's rights, but all human rights for decades. She's an attorney by training, an extremely effective advocate, and we're always delighted to have her here at Securing America. Reggie, welcome back.
Thank you so very much, Frank. It's great to be here.
You have been leading a remarkable effort. I've been pleased to be participating in it on trying to stop something called vaccine passports. And people can find out a lot more about it at stopvaxpassports.org. I'm not sure that most of us know what that is. I mean, there's a lot of talk about masks and all of this COVID business and mandates that you have to wear them and then lockdowns and then vaccine passports, not so much, but vaccine mandates, surely. But what are the passports and why should we be concerned about them?
In my opinion, Frank, the point of the vaccine mandates is to get us to a place of requiring vaccine passports, because they are a potential tool of mass surveillance and social control based on the China social credit system. So as you just said, people are very focused on the mandating of the vaccine itself or the mandating of masks. And now that those are being rolled back and being eased up, people are being lulled into a state of complacency, and they don't realize that these vaccine passports are being rolled out. So there's an article that recently came out from Politico. It says, more GOP states are now wagering on vaccine passports technology, but they're not calling them vaccine passports because we have succeeded in getting that terminology to be radioactive. So they're calling them smart health cards and they're marketing them as, oh, this is a convenience. But according to tech experts, the same functionality that can be that comprises the China social credit system can be attached to these vaccine passports. And I'm talking about the digital apps on your phone, not a paper passport, digital apps on your phone. Same functionality as the China social credit system.
Then let's back the lens up a little bit and talk about what that is. People may be familiar with the term social credit, but I suspect they don't really understand what it means in practice, let alone if it were to be applied in our own country, not just China or elsewhere.
Okay, so let's talk about China. The China social credit system is it's a 360-degree view that they get of you digitally. So all of these different things are put together to come up with a credit score. So they have your facial recognition. They have real-time geolocation. They know exactly where you are. They are tracking all of your social media posts, your internet search history, your internet spending history, criminal history, medical history, where you work, where you live, your credit cards, your bank accounts, and also your COVID status. So they put this all together. They come up with a score. And if you have a high score, you will have privileges in society, which are really just rights. So you will have rights like you can travel. You can keep your job. Your kid can get into a good school. You can borrow money to get a house. If you do searches that they don't like a search for what happened on Tiananmen Square or Free Tibet or Taiwan invasion, anything that they don't like, Xi Jinping, Winnie the Pooh, okay, you search for that, your score is going to plummet. So what's going to happen? You're not going to be able to borrow money to buy a home. You can lose your job. Your kid cannot get into a good school. You will not be able to travel, okay? And if it goes down below that, they can freeze your credit cards and your bank account, so you will be unable to live. And we saw a version of that in Canada for the truckers and the people who supported them. And if it goes low enough, they can disappear you in a moment's notice because they know exactly where you are at all times.
Now, Reggie, when you say they, obviously in communist China, you're talking about the Chinese Communist Party can do all of this to you. You're commenting on Canada is a reminder that this is not necessarily confined to that particular communist totalitarian system. It can happen in the West as well. To the extent that this can happen, there's actually evidence that governors, including Republican governors in our country, have been helping advance, or at least not opposing, the institution of these so-called smart health cards here. Talk a little bit about what's happening on that front, and what are you trying to do about it?
Well, okay, so here's this political article, which I mentioned, and they said that now technology is gaining momentum in at least 5 states, Arizona, Mississippi, South Carolina, Oklahoma, and Utah, to impose these smart health cards. I have to say, Maryland...
Those would all be Republican governors' states.
Yes. Okay. But I want to say something, that in Maryland, they were trying to impose it and we opposed it. And I sent, you know, an email to all the key legislators about this and they backed down. They backed down so that now vaccine passports are off the table in Maryland. These can be opposed effectively. So what we are doing is we have an Align Act campaign on the stopvaxpassports.org website. And this is a very powerful tool where you can just input your name, your address. You have to have that in order to send emails to legislators. And then you can...
Your legislators, specifically.
Your legislators. They require it, okay? They require that they know that you're a constituent, okay? So that you can sign up for this and send an urgent message to your legislators that you do not want this vaccine passport. And as I mentioned to you, I have an article here from Yahoo News called Worldwide Social Credit Industry. Okay, the Worldwide Social Credit Industry Infrastructure represents a $16.1 billion opportunity by 2026. So there's a major economic driver to this as well. There are companies that are drooling over providing the technology for this. So there's political reasons of surveillance and control, and there's economic reasons, and we have to stand up, because if we don't and this gets into place, what will happen is it'll be too late. Once we are being surveilled, once all of our, you know, social media posts, etc., can be attached to our bank accounts, then it's too late. There will be no dissent.
So Reggie, let me just recap. What you're saying is that there is a political head of steam in certain official circles to put into place these control mechanisms. They're not going to call them control mechanisms. They're going to call them, as I say, smart health cards. But they are capable, on very short order, of being used for control. And it's being done at the same time, even in states that have Republican leadership, as the seeming direction is in the opposite, namely relieving us of some of these mandates and lockdowns and burdens associated with, for example, a mandatory vaccination. So it's hard to overstate the importance of what you just said. I'm sure, especially with the experience of some like Maryland, where this resistance has been mounted. Our friend Naomi Wolf and her efforts have also, I think, been effective in other states. But when you look at the money, these politicians, even if it's not control, the appeal of simply having, well, I don't know, new tax revenues or new investment opportunities or something else may well be catalyzing movements that are kind of below the radar for most of us. And unless something like this Align Act campaign, and I salute you for leading on this, is advanced. And the reason it's so important that you be in touch with your own legislator is they're going to be a lot more responsive to you than just somebody else's constituent, you know? So you have this opportunity at stopvaxpassports.org to become engaged in sparing us all what may well be this, you know, incipient Chinese tool for monitoring, surveilling, and yes, controlling us to the profit of some, including in political circles. Have I got that about right?
That's exactly right, Frank. And the reason that I have been raising the alarm about this is that there are two tech experts, Naomi Wolf that you mentioned, and also Jay Valentine, who developed the fraud detection software for eBay and also the American No-Fly List. And they are the ones who have said that all of this functionality of the Chinese social credit system can be attached to the smart health card, the vaccine passport, the digital ID, whatever it is, in a matter of minutes, not hours, not weeks, months, or years, minutes. So it's, I feel like there's, that they've set a trap for us. You know, the mandates are going down and everybody's going, oh, I'm so relieved. You know, and meanwhile, this whole thing is happening under the radar screen, as you say, and we're trying to raise the alarm and stop it.
Yeah. Well, I thank you, as always, Reggie, for your leadership as well as your visits with us from time to time. This is truly, I think, the Lord's work. If we want to retain the freedoms that we hold dear, freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution, but that can be removed at will. And again, we're not making this up, folks. Think about how badly your freedoms have suffered in the course of this COVID experience to date, and then go sign up at Align Act, the StopVaxPassports.org campaign. God bless you, Reggie. Come back to us soon. Robert Spencer is up next on Jihad, and you, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And my good friend, close colleague, and revered mentor on an awful lot of issues, Robert Spencer, is with us virtually. We're delighted to have him. He is the author of innumerable books, including The Truth About Muhammad. He is also a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, but best known perhaps for his life's work, which has been the terrific online resource, jihadwatch.org, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Always glad to have Robert with us. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Always good to talk to you.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in your part of the battle space. Robert, let's start with jihad, a subject on which you are deeply knowledgeable, written extensively, and not least at Front Page Magazine and, of course, at PJ Media. You've been talking about the problem that we currently have and that we're likely to have a lot more of as the Taliban becomes emboldened by the continuing flow of money and other concessions being made by the West, including our own government. What is that likely to mean for jihad, both on their part and perhaps by others they're associated with, sir?
Well, Frank, very simply, it's going to mean more jihad, as the Taliban made it very clear when they took over in Afghanistan last year that they were going now to expand their jihad efforts to the surrounding region. And that means more jihad activity in India in particular, but also elsewhere in the area.
We're hearing about Pakistan, among other places. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And of course, Pakistan actually has a Taliban branch. And so they'll be working hand in glove with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and we will certainly be hearing from them. Meanwhile, the UN, the United States, they're completely engaged in wishful thinking. The UN just voted, the Security Council voted to continue humanitarian aid to Afghanistan and included an assurance that this money would not go to the Taliban, with absolutely, of course, no explanation of how they plan to keep the money from the Taliban, which is the only significant power in the country right now.
Right, and actually runs the government, last time I checked. So this sounds as though this is essentially new underwriting for the business of the Taliban, namely jihad. And that, of course, Robert, as we talked about with Sam Faddis last week, comes on top of the, what is it, $85 billion worth of advanced weaponry that we put in their hands at Bagram and elsewhere. It does seem as though this would be a problem in its own right, but is it true that the Taliban remains tied to organizations like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and others? And are they also training up and equipping up, presumably, in Afghanistan?
Yeah, very much so, Frank. The whole media myth that ISIS-K is at odds with the Taliban, that is the Khorasan province, the Islamic State's presence in Afghanistan is somehow competing with or fighting against the Taliban, this is wildly overblown. The ISIS group has taken exception to the Taliban's focus on Afghanistan, but the Taliban itself has said repeatedly that it's going to expand its operations outside Afghanistan, and that means it's going to be working hand in glove with ISIS and with Al-Qaeda, which also has been documented as having a continued presence in Afghanistan, despite assurances by Joe Biden to the contrary.
Let me ask you the money question here. Do you agree with Sam Faddis, who spent a lot of time working against these guys, of course, as a CIA operative in Pakistan, Robert, that it's not just in places like Pakistan that you're going to see this jihad taking place? It will be coming here as well. And if that's the case, would you anticipate that at least some of the 100,000 or so Afghans we rushed over here when we surrendered Afghanistan will be participating in that jihad?
There's just no doubt about it, Frank. You know, what would be really surprising would be if none of those Afghans that we've brought over participated in jihad, because the Biden administration has now admitted that the overwhelming majority of over 125,000 Afghans that are now in the United States were not vetted at all. And the only vetting that was even possible in the first place was to compare their names to various criminal and terrorist databases. Now, that may have caught a few people, but the fact is that there was a massive brisk business in false identifications in Kabul and in the surrounding areas toward the end of the American presence there. And so in the first place, we don't have any real assurance that these people are who they say they are. They have not been vetted. Even if they were vetted, it's very likely that some of them have gotten through. There have already been arrests of several of the so-called refugees for violating American law in ways that correspond with Afghan cultural norms. One thing that is absolutely certain is that from these Afghan refugees, we're going to have more of this kind of societal disruption and, above all, more jihad.
And I think it's correct to say that a good number of them, if not actually a majority of the 125,000, I didn't realize it was that high, are military age men to boot. So again, my favorite ask is, what could possibly go wrong here? Robert, we're going to have to pause for just a moment in a second, but I did want to just tee up another topic with you, and that is another engine of jihadism in the world, of course, is the Iranian regime. There are reports that this deal that the Biden administration has maniacally pursued with the mullahs will result in a transfer of $10 billion additional dollars to them. Is that your understanding very quickly?
Yes, and it's actually worse. $150 billion is set to go to the Islamic regime if this deal goes through.
My Lord. Well, we're going to drill down on that because we transferred $150 billion to them under Obama, as I recall. Pallets of cash, people may remember. And the upshot of it was not an end to the nuclear weapons program, certainly not the nuclear weapons ambitions of the mullahs, last time I checked. Nor, I think, will it be in this case either, Robert Spencer. When we come back, I want to visit with you about what it means that you have a jihadist regime bent on achieving what they believe is Allah's will, namely the triumph of Sharia over the entire world, able to wield nuclear weapons to that end. It's a chilling thought, and we're going to talk about what it might mean in practice. Robert Spencer is our guest of jihadwatch.org. We'll be right back with more with Robert Spencer after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Robert Spencer is in the house virtually, I'm very pleased to say, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and a prodigiously impactful contributor to the public policy debate about what I think of as Sharia supremacism and what it means for all of us that it is on the march. Robert, we were talking about the Iran deal briefly. Give us an update on what is in this thing, as best we can tell, and whether it is likely to result in, either an end to the nuclear ambitions of the mullahs, as we've been promised again and again and again, or even just an end to the jihadist terrorism with which this regime has most prominently been associated.
Frank, Gabriel Noronha, who's a former State Department official, has had access to the deal as it stands. And he warns that it looks as if from the loosening of various sanctions, from the unfreezing of various assets, the Iranian regime stands to gain $150 billion. And that money is virtually certain to go to financing international jihad groups. When the Obama administration showered billions of dollars on the Islamic Republic of Iran, we were assured that that money would go to improve the lot of the Iranian people. Not a penny of it went to improve the lot of the Iranian people. It went to Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and interestingly enough, various leftist political parties in other parts of the world, in notably Spain. Now, what's wild about the new Iran deal is that it's likely to do the same thing, despite the fact that the Iranian people themselves have been protesting and saying, stop sending money to Gaza, to Syria, to Lebanon, start spending it here on your own people. But the Iranian regime, which probably would have fallen if the Trump-era sanctions had continued, is being propped up now by the Biden administration and directly going against the wishes of its own people is going to be bankrolling terrorism around the world.
Yeah, making it much more dangerous, not just for its own people, but for the rest of us as well, of course. Robert, you mentioned the left, and I appreciate so much the attention you're giving to what I've thought of as the red-green axis. This deal with the Iranians is a prime example of it, I suppose. Talk a little bit about some of the research that you've done into the left in America and its enthusiasm, of all things, for Vladimir Putin at the moment, specifically the so-called squad on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, Frank, really, as the anger at Russia is taking the form of punitive actions against individual Russians who have no influence over Vladimir Putin. One notable holdout in all the hysteria is the squad, but they're not to be praised for this. They are actually in Putin's pocket for some quite interesting reasons. Ilhan Omar, most notably, has family connections that are involved with Russian oil. And it's interesting to note that she voted against sanctions on the Russian oil industry. Seems to be entirely self-serving. And she has come out against sanctions, saying that they always hurt various people involved with them. And yet, of course, she's strongly in favor of the BDS sanctions movement against Israel. So yes, there's no consistency here. It's entirely self-serving.
Well, it might be called a conflict of interest, I think, fairly. But when you talk about Ilhan Omar's family relationships, of course, this is a woman who is alleged to have married her own brother. So family ties are a complicated thing for the Omar family, I suppose. One other quick topic, Robert. There is, I think, underway an effort to take a fresh look, shall we say, at Hunter Biden's laptop. The New York Times, no less, has now confirmed, albeit, I gather, in the 24th paragraph of a long article on the subject, that it actually is Hunter Biden's laptop, and the documentation of it is authentic. And I ask this because you had a piece recently in which you asked the question, whatever became of those 50 or so veteran intelligence officers who profoundly assured us that this laptop was Russian disinformation, nothing to see here, folks. Don't have any qualms about voting for Joe Biden, which was the practical effect of their intervention on the eve of the 2020 presidential election. Do you know the answer? What became of them? And have they changed their tune?
The New York Post recently went to all of them, and almost all of them declined comment. A few of them stuck by the story. The three CIA directors, Leon Panetta, Michael Hayden, and John Brennan, who signed the letter saying that the laptop was Russian disinformation, they declined comment. And it's very clear that this whole thing saying that it was fake was the real disinformation and an indication of how corrupt and partisan our intelligence community has become. And now that the truth has come out and is absolutely definitively established, even by the trusted organs on their own side, they're cornered. But of course, they know that even though the New York Times has now acknowledged this, the New York Times is not going to come after them and say, how did you, why did you lie about this to the American people? And the corrupt establishment is still very much in place to the detriment of us all.
Well, the simple truth of the matter is we know why they lied to the American people, and that was to advance the political purpose for which they've devoted much of their highly partisan lives, including in their intelligence community roles. Indeed, I think one of the darkest aspects of what's been done to this country in the wrecking operation during the years in which the intelligence community waged war against Donald Trump, and then most especially during this administration, has been the weaponization of our national security agencies, and of course the intelligence agencies most especially, for partisan political purposes. It's not just scandalous, really. It is a desperately serious threat to the country of this constitutional republic. And I fear, Robert, that if these folks are not held accountable, there will be more of this to come. And I appreciate you calling them out. And I hope that there will be more evidence of how truly dishonorably they've conducted themselves, and possibly criminally. So certainly engaging in political manipulation at a critical time in our history. Thank you, Robert Spencer. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Thank you for listening to this edition of Securing America. Check out securingamerica.tv for more, and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.